So I've been reflecting on some weird coming together of two themes, which I'll share with you tonight, and we'll see how that goes. And then when I run out of intelligent things to say, which might be very quick, then we can do something that Carolyn suggested, which is talk a little bit about Zacho Jie's teachings last weekend and kind of do a little bit of a debrief, although she says she can't remember anything, but I'm sure Steve can. So, no, you can't put Lakedon on the spot. That's not fair. You can put Kayla on the spot. That's all right.
I remember one thing.
All right, well, that'd be a good place to start. So the two things that have been coming together for me that I want to talk about tonight they're about the word place or center in this case. So let me start at that place, which is that okay, April Fool's Day, right? So to go back to this. Every once in a while I mention this, that some time ago we wrote to Denma Lhotse Rinpoche and asked him for a name for whatever it was that we were doing here. And he offered a couple possibilities, and he did that in cursive Tibetan handwriting, which I can't read. So I sent it down to Tenzin Dorje, an old translator colleague of mine who's now a professor in Southern California. When I met him, he was skinnier than Lakedon here and a monk. And he's no longer skinny, he's no longer a monk, but he's a first-rate translator. And I asked him if he would translate the cursive handwriting. It's called Tibetan Quick Script, which I can't read, as I said. And he said he'd be glad to do that. He sent it back up to me, and he said basically what it was that Lhotse Rinpoche had given two possible names for the center. And, two possible names for what we were doing. And in both cases, Tenzin translated them as center for, which is kind of common Buddhist language now, which comes from Zen Center in San Francisco when they first organized themselves. For whatever reason, they called themselves a center. They didn't want to call themselves a church. They couldn't call themselves a monastery exactly because there were men and women living there. And there were, anyhow, a lot of different reasons they called themselves a center, and that caught on. And most Buddhist groups refer to themselves as centers, like Dharma Center of one kind or another. Dharma is a Sanskrit word for what we call Buddhism. It means 18 different things, one of which is the law, another one of which is the teaching, which is basically the same thing, or organization or order or something like that. Anyway, so all these Dharma centers, right? So Tenzin offered a couple of translations, and I looked at them and I thought, okay, finding the path to liberation makes sense rather than the place for the initial mind training, which is the other possibility. Because I thought, you know, Americans would run away from mind training, but they might not run away from liberation. Unless they knew what it was, of course, in which case they definitely would run away from it. I'm sorry. Sarcastic humor. Anyway, so he translated the name that Rinpoche gave us as Center for Finding the Path to Liberation. And I felt really uncomfortable about using that word. So if you've been paying attention to the email signatures, you'll see that we've been group, place, and now finally center, because I finally accepted that. And I had to think about that. And I had to look at the etymology of the word, the Tibetan word that Rinpoche had used. Now, this is all germane to, you know, everything. I'm getting there. So the word that he used, sulk in Tibetan, signifies a coming together, usually for engaging in a Vajrayana ritual of some sort. a group of people coming together to practice meditation in one place. That's what it refers to at heart or at root, soak. And Tenzin translated it at center, which is a kind of a stretch, but with American English it actually does fit. But it made me kind of uncomfortable for a number of reasons. And then Kay and I talked about it, and I realized that, yeah, okay, it actually did fit. But there were a number of reasons why I thought it fit, and it had to do, as much as anything, with thinking about what is a gathering, what is a place where a gathering happens. And the way my thinking on that went was maybe a little bit of a surprising turn. One of the main symbols in Buddhism is what in Sanskrit is called a stupa, and in Tibetan is called a chorten. And the etymology of that is chö ten. Chö means the same thing as dharma in Tibetan. And ten, which is spelled R-T-E-N in Tibetan. So that's how you get chorten, Americanized Tibetan, sorry. But that's the way you get it. Ten, R-T-E-N, means a holder, a place where something is held. So this is a chorten, so you can pass around and look at it. It's a Tibetan version of a stupa. Symbolically, it's the mind of a Buddha, just as this is the body of a Buddha. This is the mind of a Buddha, and all the shapes in the chorten represent a certain sort of mind energy aspect of Buddha. Square, earth element, they symbolize specific skandhas we've talked about. And you can go through all the symbolism, which I don't actually want to do tonight. There's not really a great point in doing that. Now, one of the things that these are used for as reliquaries. So, for example, if a text has gotten totally worn out, an old Buddhist scripture has gotten totally worn out, what do you do with it? Because it's sacred writing. It's the word of the Buddha, one of the three bodies of the Buddha, mind of the Buddha, speech of the Buddha, body of the Buddha. What do you do with it? Well, traditionally, those would be put in chortens. And some very interesting old texts have been found in Western Tibet and Ladakh because it's so dry. They've been preserved for a very long time. So for scholars and archaeologists, that's very convenient. But the point is, it's a holder. It's a sacred space that holds something. Just like a tsok is a sacred space where people come together to do something or to hold something. And that's what I wanted to get at with the talk today, is what are people holding when they come together in a special place, which we would now call a Dharma center. So what they're holding is something similar to what's being held in the chorten, because what's being held there is the mind of a Buddha. It symbolizes the mind of the Buddha, but it is the mind of the Buddha, and it holds the mind of a Buddha. When we do our Vajrasattva practice, for example, we go through some steps which are typical for any Vajrayana sadhana. In almost any sadhana, you begin by establishing a motivation for doing what you're doing. Usually, the motivation would want to be an altruistic motivation, which is to say that you're engaged in the activity you're about to engage in, whatever it is, for the benefit of all beings, remembering that all beings includes you. Okay. Now, I could, you know, if I was a half-competent teacher, I could talk all day on what that means, but I'm not going to. For all kinds of reasons. In the beginning, you establish the motivation, or as Achuje would say, by the way, chö, dharma, jē, king, dharma king, Satchuje. he would, excuse me, establishing the motivation would be the first step, and then you engage in the practice of the sadhana. He usually begins by appreciating one's lineage, or includes the appreciation of one's lineage, one's teachers, okay, one's teachers, and various other kinds of preliminary prayers. But then finally what you get down to is visualizing yourself in the form of a Buddha of one form or another, whether it's this form or Vajrasattva as we've been doing or something like that. And then the next step, I'm cutting through a whole lot of stuff, but then the next step is you visualize that same Buddha in front of yourself, in the air in front of yourself, in the space in front of yourself, and then you imagine it coming to your head and merging with you. And that's sort of an essential piece of the practice, because what you're doing when you visualize yourself in the form of the Buddha is you're turning yourself into a holder, into a ten, like a chorten. You're turning yourself into that which is going to hold Buddha nature. Then you imagine it outside of yourself, and then you imagine the merging. You imagine it coming into yourself, and you now hold it within yourself. Now, this is a complete fiction in a certain sense, because you've already got a Buddha mind in the center of yourself, which is what you are. It's just that you don't know it. That's the human problem. We're Buddhas and we don't know it. We have to cultivate our Buddha nature, which is a matter of remembering what we actually already are, which we've forgotten about because we've gotten so involved and outwardly directed into our life in the world. And we've so obscured our minds with our own created confusion that we've forgotten our actual nature. So we have to re-remember our actual natures. And so we end up playing a game with ourselves. And the game that we play with ourselves is, I'm me and the Buddha's over there. And so now I'm going to visualize the Buddha there. I'm going to pretend that I'm a Buddha. And then I'm going to imagine the Buddha out there joining with me in here, and I'm the holder for the Buddha. That's the game we play with ourselves when we're doing a sadhana, when we're doing a meditation practice. But it's a game, because actually we're already the Buddha. The Buddha isn't out there. The Buddha's in here. Except for the fact that out there is created by our own consciousness, and out there and in here are no different than each other, which is another game we play with ourselves, that they're different from each other, which they're not. So we're playing games on top of games on top of games on top of games to unobscure our minds, starting with the thick delusion we're in of the Buddha and I are separate, and symbolically moving through that delusion to remember that the Buddha and I are the same. And the key transition in that, from my point of view, and this is after 25 years of doing one specific sadhana practice, the key transition at that point, from my point of view, is the moment when, having visualized yourself as a Buddha and having visualized a Buddha outside of yourself, whatever form, Vajrasattva, Vajrabhairava, Tara, it doesn't really make any difference, they're all different forms of the Buddha, and then you imagine that joining with yourself. It's the same as the process of Guru Yoga, where you imagine the Lama is outside of yourself, and then the Lama joins with you. And for those of you who do go to Long Beach and take on the Vajrabhairava practice or anything like that, an essential part of what you'll be doing is Guru Yoga 6 times a day, which is remembering your relationship with the Lama. Guru, same thing. Lama is Tibetan for guru. Remembering your relationship with the Lama, starting out with the ordinary perception of Lama and student are two different things, moving into the more realized, truthful recognition of the fact that Lama and student are not two things. Now, as Kay said, whenever I ask Lhotse Rinpoche a question, he essentially gives me the equivalent of what would be called a koan in Zen, which is to say, he answers my question in a way that just will drive me berserk and force me to think about all kinds all kinds of stuff that, you know, circles around the answer to the question, and then the answer leads to something else. And that's fair, because that's what I do to all my poor students in my online classes. They ask a question on the discussion board, and I answer their question with another question. And the, you know, the intrepid ones keep on, and the less intrepid ones stop asking me questions. It's too bad, because it's much more interesting if we have the dialogue of I answer their question with a question. It's not like they don't get an answer, but they get a provocative answer. So Rinpoche does the same thing. Not Zatchoji Rinpoche, who usually answers my questions, but sort of. He answers them on multi-levels, but he gives me a straight answer. Denma Lhotse Rinpoche never gives me a straight answer. So when I asked him the question about what should we name what we're doing here, of course he gave me one of those goes around in circles, drives me crazy kinds of things, and you're hearing the upshot of it today. Where was I going with this? I forgot where I was going with this.
Center place.
What?
Place, center.
Yes, place, center, and so on. Okay, yeah. So, yeah, so it kind of led into this whole conversation about what are we and what are we doing here, and this whole issue about the fiction of our separation. That's really what it was, the whole fiction of our separation from ourselves. And as Choje said in Yakima, over and over again, he talked about reconnecting with yourself. So he's learned good Americanisms. He talks about reconnecting with yourself. Reconnecting with yourself is what I've been talking about, which is to say, you imagine yourself as outside of yourself, capital S self, if you will, and then you imagine your capital S self as yourself. And that's reconnecting with yourself through this meditation practice of joining the outside imagined Lama or the outside imagined Buddha, bringing it into yourself in this particular process with yourself as the container or the holder, allowing it to enter you, allowing it to live in you, and practicing I am that, which we've all forgotten. We've all forgotten what I really am. We think I am the body. I am the mind. I am the personality. I am the feelings. I am the husband. I am the professor. I am the cook. I am the mother. I am the this. I am the that. But what we forget over and over again is what I really am, which is, among other things, all of those things, but also something that contains all of those things, that's a space that's larger than all those things, that embraces all those things, which is our Buddha nature, pure consciousness, if you will, which includes everything. And so this is what we're practicing. So when we practice Vajrasattva this evening, we're going to do Buddha meditation tonight. Okay, when we do the meditation on Buddha tonight, you know, what we're practicing is Buddha's outside of me to I am Buddha. And that's the important thing to remember. Okay, so that's all I have to say.
Do you want to talk in regards to what Zatchoji was saying? Do you want to talk a little bit more about he emphasized again, it's like in the last two or three times, that the meditations on the different parts of ourselves? Because that was a strong theme.
About the five skandhas,
yeah,
and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, or don't you? Just to review them in case people haven't heard.
Okay.
You say that, and then there's some things I want to say about it. If you want to.
No, you
begin.
Want
me to say that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, to review those, one of the things that he was focusing on Friday night was that it was really important to ground ourselves before we do any meditations, really, any Vajrayana meditations, in meditating and familiarizing ourselves with the different parts of ourselves. And one of the parts is the body, you know, and then there's the body.
Perception.
Perceptions or feelings, right? I just don't want to get the order wrong.
Well, body, okay, I'll do the
feeling,
order then.
Okay.
body feelings in the sense of preference, of what is attractive, what is unattractive, or what we're attracted to and what we're repelled by and what we're neutral toward. Perceptions, of which there's six types of perception. Perception through the eye, perception through the ear, perception through the nose, perception through the tongue, perception of touch, perception of thought. Thoughts are perceptions. We're aware of ideas, which is actually very interesting. I'm starting to read about some some brain science, I should say, and the whole idea that we perceive thoughts rather than anything else is validated by that. Then the fourth thing is karmic formations, habits, which Zacho Jay calls energy, which is always incredibly interesting to me. Yeah. We could talk about that for a long time. And then the fifth thing is consciousness. And then what arises out of the concatenation of all of those five categories of experience is the label I, which we apply to that. And all of those things live within the space of our Buddha nature. That's the way he phrased it.
And one of the surprising things that he said about that was, like, he said that we really have to do that deeply. And I think that's one thing we haven't focused on so much here. I mean, we do it a little bit when I start the meditation process, you know, because first of all, we start with our body, you know, our body position. We're doing some exercises, you know, to ground our body and our energy and to pull our energy into our central channel. And watching the breath, you know, watching, you know, for pain in the body and so on and so forth. We haven't focused so much on some of the other things, like our sensual apparatus, like, the five senses, or on our feelings. And we do a little bit in our thoughts. And I don't know what kind of meditations you do at home, if you're doing silent meditation where you're just watching your thoughts sometimes to see what arises there. But he said that, my concern was, I was saying, well, if you don't do this, if you don't ground in this, then this, you know, create a problem later on when you're doing your, you know, tantric meditations and so forth. Though I do think in reality the tantric meditations tend to integrate a lot of this stuff within to them, so you're doing them kind of all at once. But he said no, not really problems, he said, but he said you can take one of these, like the body, and you can like meditate on this up to a year, you know, like a year. So he wasn't talking about just dipping into it for a few minutes here and there. He was talking about, well, you know, focus on the body for a year, and then maybe you want to focus your feelings for a year, and your energy, for a year, you know, so on and so forth. So he said, so this is something that I thought would be interesting to you guys, because, you know, one of the things that you can do in addition to your daily meditation practice is just take one of those, you know, maybe every day take a different one, and just play with it a little bit and start, you know, watching your thoughts or watching, you see if you can sense the energy, you know, in your body, and watch, you know, maybe your sense of smell, just work on that day, just following that. A lot of that is in the Theravadin practice. That's a lot of what you're doing in that particular practice, is you're watching all these different parts of yourself to become really familiar with it. And then one of the lovely things when talking about what happened that Friday night too was that he was talking about once you've done all that the Buddha mind, how it is this open, sky-like, luminous mind, and that it has a lot to do with flowing with that particular mind and not struggling with it, not trying to control it, and so on and so forth. And in him speaking about it, I personally found it very, I felt all my kind of tension, just when I, even thinking about that concept of this open, vast, sky-like mind space. I mean, all of everything just kind of dissipated and kind of fell away. And so I think that's another thing that's really important to concentrate on sometimes, is just, you know, being in that space of that open sky-like mind, trying to open yourself up to it, not trying to control it, not trying to struggle it. So there's so many different variations on, you know, so if we get bored, you know, one of the things that happens with this lot too, I think it was our meditation, we just get bored, right? We're doing the same thing every day. So, you know, within your Tara practice or within your just quiet meditation in the morning or whatever you're doing, if you can pick up one of these other things to kind of integrate, I think it'll, that it is important, and then it will open up a lot of, you know, new vistas in your practice and interest, you know, perhaps. So, do you have anything to add to that?
You were quite eloquent. I have nothing to add.
The other thing I wanted to talk about that happened that not Friday night was just, you know how we've been, like, you haven't seen this, but we've been doing this, the meditation with this particular form of the Buddha, which is holding the lotus in his right hand. And Zlatuja told this story, which I've heard in another kind of version of. But basically, he was talking about, and I found it incredibly moving, and I think part of that was because we've been doing this practice with this form of Buddha. And the story went that the Buddha was sitting there in India, and he was surrounded by his disciples, and he was doing talks. Hi there! Hey, come on in. And he was doing talks, and two children came up to the edge of the crowd of disciples, and they had gathered lotus flowers for him. And they walked up to the edge of the crowd, and people were just kind of ignoring them, and he said, you know, to make a space. So they opened up this space for the children to come forward, and they were so sweet, and they held this beautiful lotus flower for him, and came up to him, and he accepted the offering. And then he held it up in his right hand, just like in this image that we're working with, and just sat there and stared at it, for a long time. And to the point, actually, he was quiet, where his disciples became kind of, you know, uneasy, like, what's going on here? Why did he stop his talk? And so on and so forth. And what was happening was that he had entered that spacious sky like mind and basically was interconnecting with everything, and could see the universe within that lotus. And one of his disciples,
Mahakashapa,
I never pronounce it right, Mahakashapa, finally got that's what was going on, and he just started laughing, you know. He was filled with joy and just started laughing and laughing. And the Buddha looked at him, and he realized that he had understood what was going on. Mm-hmm. And in other versions of the story, Mahakashapa just smiles, and the Buddha understands that. So he has his own awakening moment along with the Buddha in that. But it's just the whole idea of that incredible, open, spacious mind is filled with a lot of joy. You know, we talk about it as bliss, but that it's filled with that. And that you can see the universe within a lotus flower. And it also talked about the purity of the offering, too, coming from these little children. So I just wanted to share that, since it is the image of the Buddha that we're working with here over and over again. And I thought that it might also enhance your practice. Because if you've ever thought about that, when we were picturing that lotus, if you've never thought about it in that way. I had a lot of big hits this weekend on things that really touched my life deeply, but what about you guys, Steve, or do you have any memory of anything that you
want to
share?
It's been 2 weeks. It
seems like it, but actually one.
It was only last weekend? one of the things I appreciated and have thought on is you talked about three basic points in this teaching on Saturday. The first one around learning to observe the mind, I believe it was. And the second one around just going with whatever comes up in the mind and not judging it, not trying to control it. And the third one around recognizing that it's all stories, and is suggestion to not believe all the stories, but to believe 50%. 50-50. 50-50. Which I found interesting because I wonder how to choose that 50% and why to hold on to 50% when they're all made up.
That was amazing, wasn't it? That whole thing I thought about that too so much afterwards. It's like the next few days it was like everything that my mind created, I'm going, here's another story I'm creating about what reality is. And his whole premise it was to not try and control it. That's what we were talking about earlier, Carolyn. It's like not trying to control it, the mind, but letting the mind do it, because the mind loves to make stories. That's what it does. And just not get it. The whole point is just to not get attached to the stories that the mind is making up. And it is, so that was a very different way of looking at it, because lots of times he said we do get stuck in trying to control, we got to control the mind, because the mind's going off and doing all this stuff. And he said instead to just kind of relax into it and just let it flow and just watch the stories. And he goes, enjoy them. Yeah. The mind's creative, it's artistic, it loves to create stories.
He called the mind a playground.
A playground, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the reason he said 50%, and you know that's totally arbitrary.
Oh really? I thought it was precise.
Right. The reason he said that is because obviously, if you're a monk, you can just decide to not believe any story. But if you live in the world, your mind is creating stories, and some of them are pretty practical. You know, like paying your taxes is a story. Or if I don't pay my taxes, this is what's going to happen, is another story. That's a reasonable story to listen to, you know. It's not like paying your taxes is a big deal. Well, you just have to do it. And, you know, you can watch all the drama that goes on in your mind around doing your tax returns. Obviously, this is on my mind. All the drama that's going on in your mind around doing your tax returns and why am I being honest here? I'm not going to get audited, but I might get audited, so I better be honest, just in case I feel like cutting some corners. Where did that story come from? Who told me that? Oh, you know, you can, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, they are all stories, but we do live in the world, right? And so the mind tells us stories about the world that we live in, and sometimes they're good stories and useful stories. And then there are stories which are important, good, useful stories, like, may all beings be happy. May all beings be free of suffering. That's a good story. I mean, ultimately, you know, all beings are Buddhas, so they're neither happy nor unhappy. But since they're wallowing in confusion, since we are wallowing in confusion, it's a good story to think when I'm being... this is the other thing you talked about. When we think, oh, poor me, I'm sick, all this horrible stuff's happening, to remember, well, there are a lot of people who are sick, and if I'm feeling miserable, it's an opportunity for me to remember that other people are miserable, and wouldn't it be nice if none of us were miserable, and not just wouldn't it be nice if I wasn't miserable, and wow, I'm feeling really happy today, isn't that great? Wouldn't it be nice if a lot of people were feeling happy today? Wouldn't that be wonderful? Well, let me think, it would be nice for all people to be happy when I'm happy, instead of I'm happy and now I'm going to feel guilty about being happy because everybody else is miserable. That was very helpful to me, because I've had some pretty miserable thoughts in the last week, and it was actually alleviating of a lot of that miserableness to think, I'm not the only miserable person around. Wouldn't it be nice if all of us were less miserable? It actually made me less miserable to think that. That's called mind training. So in spite of the fact that Lhotse Rinpoche said, place for the initial mind training, and I thought, no, we don't want to do that. That's, there we are. That's what we're doing. Place for the initial mind training. Baby steps. He wasn't going to call us place for mind training. Place for the initial mind training.
Mind taming, is that what he finally
yes.
said?
Yes. Yeah, training? That's right. Thank you. That's right. He said training, yeah, Americans don't want training. Taming. Taming is better than training.
Better, but still not. He said still not really the word he wanted.
Yeah, but I don't think he could find quite the word he wanted, did he? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Taming, mind taming. Now there's a chore. Mind taming by letting
enjoy. Well, enjoy it is by enjoying it, you tame it.
By just letting it flow and not believing it. And that's how you tame it, by just letting it flow but not believe everything it tells you. It's sort of like, don't worry about it. If you get your taxes in late, you just pay a fine and the IRS is not going to haul you off. Do not worry about this.
No big deal.
No big deal.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Oh, yeah, stop off. Stop off.
The new mantra is Om, no big deal.
No big deal. I kind of like that. And then Sabha and the gal next to me who's been going to his lectures many times says, Sabha means so be it. Does that sound
Swaha.
Right? So be it.
Yeah.
Om, no big deal, so
Swaha.
Be it.
Yeah,
so
ha.
So be it.
What's the last word that you should say? It's S-V-A-H-A.
S-O-B-V-H-A, does that sound
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's it, yeah, Sabha. Yeah. Or Swaha.
Sabaha?
Om, so be it, Swaha.
Swaha?
Swaha, S-V-A-H-A.
Now, Swaha is being, though, right? Isn't that what you translate Swaha as?
Mm-hmm.
As being, so be it. Being.
So being.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. These things have rounded meanings.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
They don't have sharp edges and corners. Mm-hmm. Remember Dharma, 18 meanings.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask about that, because so you said at first that Dharma basically means Buddhism. So it means the whole thing, and the 18
yes.
aspects of it, apparently there's a lot of nuance to that, and that's not surprising. But I mean, basically, if I take my concept of Buddhism and just say that's basically what Dharma means, but of course it's not that simple, I'll be pretty close.
Yeah, that sounds good. One of the things that Dharma means is the Buddha's teaching. Another thing that Dharma means is righteousness or law or pattern or correct pattern. But another thing that Dharma means is a thing. So the world is made up of atoms or things. They're called dharmas in the Buddhist psychology. But if you think about these things, and I won't go into the other 15, which I can't remember right now anyway, but if you think about it, a pattern, a thing, truth, righteousness, the Buddha's teaching, they're all the same thing, in a sense. A dharma, which means non-truth, non-righteousness, non-teaching, is that which is also unreal, and therefore it's a not thing, not in the Zen sense of no thing, which is a complicated translation of a Chinese concept, which is a translation of a Hotanese concept, which is a translation of a Sanskrit concept, so it's very confusing. But a non-thing doesn't exist. I mean, there are things, and there's space, but there's no anti-things, is what I'm trying to say. I mean, there are unreal things don't exist. That's what I'm trying to say. And which is non-dharma is unreal, and it doesn't exist. So yes, you're right. That's
illusion.
A long way of saying.
Would illusion be another thing for it? A-dharma?
Well, there are real illusions, but the things illusions refer to aren't real, if that makes sense.
A-dharma.
Yeah. Did I just confuse the devil out of everybody with that? Okay, here.
You're using A-dharma like you'd use amoral.
Yeah, that's what I'm catching too.
And I'm not saying they're the same thing, but you're
okay.
You're using the phraseology. To
sure.
The absence of.
Sure. Yeah, okay. And I won't go into the thing about real illusions then. We'll stay away from that.
Well, if you have an illusion, it's real, but what it's about isn't.
It's not. Right. And that's exactly it. The metaphor that Buddhists use is a mirage. If you're driving through the desert, okay, and you see a mirage, it's a real mirage. If you think it's a lake, it's not a lake. It's a false lake, but it's a real false lake. It's a real mirage. The mirage is actually there, but the lake is not. So what the mirage refers to is not there. So the mirage is every concept you could possibly have is a mirage. It refers to something that's completely false. Okay, subject of next week's conversation. Okay, let's go eat some biscottis.
I think we should end this with what we decided. We talked with Kathy, or Leslie, and Michael, who brings the Chujin all the time to, and has been for years, to Yakima. And one of the things that we decided to do was to, instead of bringing him here, that we are going to work together to try and find, they're going to try and find as many people as they can to offer you all spaces up there so that it won't cost you an arm and a leg if you want to go hear him. And then we're going to try and arrange carpools because they're very much saying, come, join us. You know, we'll try and put you guys up. You know, David and I'll try and help with carpooling, you know, organizing that so that people can get up there and back, and we're going to try and do that instead. He's really busy, and I think he would come if we really, you know, tried to pin him down. But I think in the long run, that it's probably, you know, if they're willing to do that, and they were more very much so. They loved having, you know, the people that came this time. They loved having, you know, us there. And for the Friday night after the Friday night teaching that he does, it's a public talk. The group itself, and they said our group is welcome to join, goes out to this Japanese restaurant and has you know, dinner with him, which is fun. It's just kind of a fun social thing. And she said that everybody from here is invited to do that. And the only thing that Leslie needs to know ahead of time is a count so that we don't freak out the waitress that always hosts this restaurant.
Who sort of freaked out last time. This table keeps getting longer and longer.
They don't announce it to the public talk because they want it, you know, they don't want it to get so huge that it's like 75 people come or something. So anyway, so everybody's invited to that. And, you know, and the Saturday talks are from 10 till 4. So anyway, that's kind of the route we've decided to go.
Right, and he'll probably be back again in
May.
Right, in May.
That'll be the next time.
And
does he have four times a year or three times a year? Or do we know? We don't know.
Yeah, he's trying. He said last year, at the end of last fall, that he was going to try and come more to Yakima.
But he hasn't succeeded yet.
Yeah, he hasn't. So, well, he's just starting the season.
Yeah,
he's just starting.
But, you know, unfortunately, you know, people keep handing him Dharma centers as they get old and retire and things. And so he was offered all the Jewelheart Dharma centers, and he said, I don't want to do that. But he has one in New Zealand. He's got all his monasteries in Tibet. I think he has something going on in Taiwan.
Yeah.
Yeah, the things in India and Europe and the United States. It's like, you know, everyone's pulling at him now. This is what happens as lamas get older, mm-hmm. until they get so old that they're in a position to say, I'm too old, leave me alone. But he's not that old, so he's not doing that.
Yeah. So anyway, we decided, since they were really happy with, you know, people coming, and are offering this, and there's a lot of real, you know, kind of core members. There's about 10 or 12 core members there, and most of them, my guess would offer,
you know, guest rooms, couches,
they did
whatever.
They did that for Lichten this time, and they loved having him. They thought it was just great, and
of course, Lichten's charming. You know, some of us are a little bit more prickly, so who knows? Marilyn C.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
English gal.
No, the other one.
Very nice.
So we'll try and organize things. We'll tell you what's happening, and if you want to go, let us know, and then we'll communicate with them, and we'll see how many guest rooms there are, and then we'll figure out the carpooling, and who knows how this will all work out, but we'll give it a shot. Thank you for mentioning that, because I had.
Okay.
All right. Snacks.